Well, good morning. Let me get everything opened up. I just realized when I got to the hall this morning that I hadn't stored this sermon offline. Thankfully, we had enough of a connection here that I was able to do it. So hopefully I won't lose it halfway through, but I've got it on my phone just in case, so we'll see how it goes. Greetings to everybody. It's good to see all the smiling faces, I guess, minus just a few families that are over at the other location. We've got Kayla's newest here with us. It's good to see him with here in the audience. And even though it's raining outside, it's nice in here. Let's begin. Canada, recently. And this is an interesting thought because we've heard many times about the atmosphere changing up in Canada as far as some of the rights that they no longer have up there. But they recently passed, when I say recently, I'd say 2016, I believe. They recently passed Federal Bill C-16, which adds gender identity and gender expression to the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Criminal Code. This means that you can potentially be breaking the law in Canada if you do not use the correct pronoun for a person's gender identity. In New York City, you can now be fined up to $250,000 if you do not call someone by their preferred pronoun. From a Washington Post opinion column by Eugene Volokh, he writes, quote, "The New York City human rights law requires employers, landlords, and all businesses and professionals to use an employee's, tenant's, customer's, or client's preferred name, pronoun, and title, regardless of the individual's sex assigned at birth, anatomy, or gender, medical history, appearance, or the sex indicated on the individual's identification," end quote. The city of New York now legally protects 31 gender identities. Facebook offers a total of 58. And I heard somewhere else online that in some places they're up to like 74 gender identities. Quite a difference from male and female, huh? We've gone way past that. There doesn't seem to be an end in sight to the moral confusion we see around us. And it just continues to go on. Most of us are familiar with Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount about not judging others. In fact, it is something very commonly quoted in today's society as a way to condemn those who try to point out some of the evils in our society today. Or it can be used against those of us who are oppressing others by refusing to use their self-imagined pronouns. It's very convenient for our society to have a Bible verse to throw at anyone who might criticize their immorality. They use the verse to convey the idea, you can live your lifestyle however you want, and I'll live mine. Don't you dare tell me how to live my lifestyle, and don't impose your standards of morality on me. Don't tell me that I'm evil, or that I'm wrong, or that I need to change. Simply accept me for what I am and what I'm doing, and I'll do the same for you. Now, that last part really doesn't seem to happen very often, does it? That they want the tolerance, but they don't really want to give it back to those of us who don't agree with them. Here is what Robert Meyer, a Christian conservative writer, said about this practice. And I want to quote just a little section out of an article he wrote titled Marginalizing Christianity by Quoting Jesus. And this was on the standupfortruth.com, February 2012, was posted on that website. But he writes, quote, "The implication of the judge not admonition is that people, particularly Christians, are not permitted to criticize what they perceive as immoral. Such an assumption is patently absurd. The point Jesus made is that we should not condemn anyone when we are even more guilty of the same offense. The actions of Jesus himself were replete with judgment against those he discerned as doing wrong. One example would be his act of overturning the tables of the money changers in the temple. If we actually extended the judgment out philosophy to its logical conclusion, it would make folly of our law enforcement and courts of law, where people are arrested, judged, and punished by other persons as a matter of course. What this is really about is marginalizing and silencing the critique of social trends or behaviors if the objection is informed by traditional moral precepts. We couldn't survive as functioning humans if we could never make judgments about people's characters based on their visible conduct. This is yet another example of a Christian beatitude distorted under the iron boot of political correctness. End quote. So what did Jesus mean by the words he preached at the beginning of Matthew 17? And this is a weighty subject. I remember talking to several people about this topic, and many of them were, really, you're going to talk about that? I mean, it is a weighty topic. I mean, in Matthew 15, it's called one of the weightier matters of the law. So what did he mean in Matthew 7? We need to tie in all the words of Jesus to truly understand the meaning behind these verses. Let's go there to Matthew 7 and read them. Matthew 7, and this is the last section of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7. In verse 1, Christ says, "Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with what measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but not consider the plank in your own eye? For how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite! First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." The Greek word used here for judge is krino, K-R-I-N-O, which means to condemn, avenge, damn, sentence, or levy a punishment. And most of the verses in the New Testament that have the English word judge use this Greek word as the translation, as the meaning, as the word underneath it. So is Christ telling us here that we are to abandon the use of our ability to use discernment toward our brethren and the world around us? That our attitude to everybody needs to be live and let live? Or is Christ warning us about how we make judgments, our attitude and approach to judgment? In the very context of these words, we are told to make judgments. When Christ says, "Do not give what is holy to dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine," how are we to make that determination? How are we to make judgments about others? What approach should we take to judgment? First, let's consider some cases where judgment was done improperly. As Jesus looked at the religious situation of his day, the people, the society, he saw that judging others had become a great problem. The Pharisees and scribes sat in the place of the critic. They were quick to pass judgment on all those who didn't live up to their expectations. They didn't consider God's expectations, but just their own expectations. Let's go to Luke chapter 8 and read about an interaction between Christ and a Pharisee. Christ goes to eat a meal with Simon, was the man's name, and a woman comes and anoints his feet with fragrant oil. So Christ is in this Pharisee's house, and a humble woman comes and anoints his feet. Now notice what Simon said. Remember that the Pharisees were very superficial with their righteousness. Luke 7, verse 36. Luke 7, verse 36. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil, and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." So Simon the Pharisee makes a judgment about Christ and this woman, and he allowed doubt to enter his mind about Christ's abilities. You know, is this guy a prophet or not? How could he allow this woman to touch him, is what he's thinking. Doesn't he know she's a sinner and worthy of harsh judgment? Simon made a hasty and wrong judgment about Christ himself. That's what happens sometimes when we make judgments in the wrong way. It doesn't just affect you and the person you are judging. Sometimes it affects other people. It can spiral out of control. The Pharisees had created a special class of people called sinners, as if they were not sinners themselves. They left themselves out of it. You know, we're over here, and all the sinners are over here. They were judging others very critically and very self-righteously. And that's what Christ used this story to point out. Let's look at another example with the Pharisees. I'm sorry. We're giving them a bad rap, I know, but they just have so many good stories. So another one with the Pharisees in John 8. John 8, verse 3. I'm trying to remember to give the verse because I know my wife is out there waiting on her pad there. What's the verse going to be? If you guys want to irritate her, just give the chapter and then wait a few seconds and give the verse. John 8, verse 3. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him, to Jesus, a woman caught in adultery. And when they set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" This they said, testing him, they might have something on which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted in their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. And when Jesus raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." So he didn't condemn her, but he also followed that up with, "Go and sin no more." So what was the problem here? Hypocrisy. The men who had brought this woman to Christ were not without sin themselves. That was also probably worthy of stoning. Some of them probably had some things in their past that, if known, would have been worthy of them being stoned as well. But once they were confronted by Christ and they thought about it, they said, I guess we probably shouldn't carry out a stoning here. Their guilt had convicted them, and they all left. So far, we've seen two examples of harsh and hasty judgment and hypocritical judgment. We've heard this next one many times. In fact, I think this was referred to last week, but let's look at it again in the context of this subject. Luke 18 and verse 9. Luke 18 and verse 9. Again, a Pharisee. Luke 18 and verse 9. This is a parable that Christ spoke. And it says, in verse 9, he says, "Also he spoke," referring to Christ, "just this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others." So here is the Pharisees again. Like I said, they had this special class of people for themselves and this other class of people for everybody else. Verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray, and one was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus to himself, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector over here. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess." And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So Christ in this parable, and it says he gave it for those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. The Pharisee had made a judgment on the other man based on his appearance, based on his profession. Apparently he could tell he was a tax collector. Notice how many times the Pharisee says, I am not like other men. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. He was conceited and self-sufficient. He, as it says in the last verse, had exalted himself. He doesn't compare himself to God's perfect standards, but another person standing next to him. Christ taught the people in the book of John not to judge according to appearances, but according to his word. John 7, verse 24, and if you don't want to write this down, I'll just read it. John 7, verse 24 says, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. Righteous judgment cannot be done with haste or harshness or by just looking at surface appearances, but only by looking at the perfect words of God as recorded for us in Scripture, and with humility and patience. So let's go back to Matthew 7. We've seen how not to judge. What are we to do with the rest of the passage? What is Christ saying here? We just read from John that we should be making righteous judgments. How we judge others is critical. As that same standard, Verse 2. Let's just drop down to verse 2. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. So how we judge others. Christ is talking about the methodology here is critical. There could be a boomerang effect, is what he's saying. That same standard will be used for us. We should not make hasty or harsh judgments against anyone. And then verse 3 says, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? So we must look at ourselves before we can even begin to consider a judgment on somebody else. Are you guilty of the same thing or something even worse in your life? Remember the Pharisees who brought the woman to Christ? We must consciously look at our own lives and seek God's mind and correction in our lives first. Verse 4. For how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Are we being hypocritical? Are you being hypocritical? Am I? Are you despising your brother like the Pharisee in Christ's parable? And after you've answered these questions, notice what Christ says. Now you can see clearly to remove the speck. There's a process to helping others, which must first begin with us looking at ourselves, at our own sins. And after we've done that, then we can help somebody else. Now, how do you want someone to remove a speck from your eye? Have you ever had a piece of dust in your eye, or even a really tiny splinter? And maybe it's in a place where you can't reach. And so you've got to have somebody else. And if you have a speck in your eye, unless you've got a really strong mirror, you may not be able to see that, to get it out. And you may not be able to reach a splinter. You're going to have some help. Now, do you want someone to come at you with a pair of pliers? Hold still. This won't hurt a bit. Or do you want them to come at you with the smallest pair of tweezers they can find and pull out that speck or pull out that splinter? You want to use the small one, right? You don't want the pliers. So if and when we're ever in a situation to be asked to remove a speck, we must have extreme humility and care for the other person. Paul points this out to us in his letter to the Galatians. Galatians 6:1. Paul's writing and he says, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such to one in a spirit of gentleness." Gentleness. "Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted." So again, he kind of reiterates, look at yourself, and then with gentleness help the other person. So we've seen there are quite a few parameters that must be used when considering the topic of judgment. The scriptures are plain that there are many positive uses of judgment that we can practice. But first, let's consider a warning that Paul gives us in Romans 14 about judgment. And many will look at this one like that they'll look at Matthew 7 and say, "Wow, it sounds like we shouldn't be doing this at all." Romans 14, verse 1. "Receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things." So notice the context. Not to disputes over doubtful things. So things that are really don't matter. Don't really matter to our salvation. Don't really matter to the trunk of the tree issues in our lives. And then he goes on and gives an example. "For one believes he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats. For God has received him. Who are you to judge another servant?" Again, remember the context. Who are we to judge other people about doubtful things, minor things? "To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand." In verse 10, drop down to verse 10. "But why do you judge your brother?" Again, think of the context of what he's writing. "For why do you show contempt for your brother? We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For as it is written, 'As I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God.' So then each of us shall give account of himself to God." So for those doubtful things, for those minor things, Paul's saying, why are you going to hold out on judgment against your brother for that? And remember that we're all going to stand before Christ. And if there is a doubtful thing or if there's something like that, Christ is probably going to say, he's going to tell us. He'll straighten it out for us. And we'll probably very quickly turn and say, "Oh, yes, you're right. I repent. I'm sorry." But now let's consider some scriptures that clearly talk about Christians exercising judgment. And for this, we're going to go to Corinthians. Paul is writing to a church. He's writing to a Gentile church in Corinth. And he's talking to them about judgment. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 6, verse 1. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 1. Paul writes here, "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law?" And the Greek word behind this word means seeking punishment or retribution. So they were going to law seeking punishment and retribution against their brethren. So starting again. "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world, and that the world will be judged by you? Are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters?" But our society around us tells us, "Don't judge me. Grant me tolerance." Yet here Paul says to them, "Can't you even judge a small matter?" Verse 3, "Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life?" So we will be judging angels, as Paul points out. So he's saying, if you're going to do that in the future, how can you not do a minor thing today to have enough discernment to do that now? Verse 4, "If then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge?" So those outside the church. "I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one, who will be able to judge between his brethren? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Now therefore it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated?" So it seems that Paul was telling them that use the wisdom within the church. Find a wise person within the church to help you settle a dispute. And don't go outside the church. How often does this happen? Frankly, I've never heard of it happening. And I guess if it did happen, we probably wouldn't want the whole church to hear of it because it would be a private thing. But I've never heard of a wise person in the church being consulted in a brethren-to-brethren dispute. Now, maybe today we consider that to go to the ministry, and that's probably appropriate in most situations. But it also doesn't disallow that if there's a wise person that you know, and you and another person are willing to go to that person for help, then why not? But that's the key thing. Are you willing? Are you willing to go to another person and accept perhaps what they may tell you is their resolution? You may not be able to. And maybe this is because we've been influenced by this society that has kind of told us, you know, hey, live and let live. Just let people, you know, leave them alone. Don't get involved. But Paul wanted them to have an attitude toward each other, wanting what was best for the other person. He didn't want them going outside the church. He wanted them to stay inside the church. And we're all striving to be helpful, to be helping each other move in a positive direction toward God's kingdom. And we all should have a deep desire for each other's spiritual success. But are we willing to have the humility to do that? And courage. It does take some courage as well. In another case, in the previous chapter, Paul tells the Corinthians, and this is just one chapter back, he actually tells them they should stay away from a brother who is sinning, transgressing the law of God. Notice most of these, as I point out here, are outwardly observable behaviors, things we can objectively see and evaluate. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9, just go back one chapter. And he talks to them about, he says, I wrote to you, verse 9, in my epistle, not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters. Since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I've written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother within our church who is sexually immoral, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or an extortioner. Not even to eat with such a person. So Christ, God, Paul is saying, hey, if you see these behaviors, this is what your reaction should be. I'm making a judgment, and I want you to make a judgment. And then he goes on and says, For what do I have to do with judging those who are outside? They're not underneath my jurisdiction, is what Paul is saying. Do you not judge those who are inside? Then he asks. But those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves the evil person. So, apparently, there was a process, and Paul told them what they needed to do. We are told by Christ later in Matthew 7, here's another example, that we are to use our judgment to discern false apostles, false prophets. Matthew 7, verse 15. Matthew 7, verse 15. Christ tells them here, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits, you will know them. Again, these are observable, objective things we can look to. Not subjective opinions or rumors. But we are clearly told to observe and make a judgment on whether what we are seeing and hearing is coming from a good tree or a bad tree. And deciding whether we should follow and mimic what we are seeing. We are not sitting in a place of condemnation, but just evaluating the fruit. As we've seen, the Pharisees had the tendency to make hasty and harsh judgments based on appearances only. They were hypocritical in their legalistic observance of God's laws, and had even added their own traditions. that made the commandments of God of no effect, as Christ sternly told them in Matthew 15. They leaned on their carnal reasoning, which always decided in their favor. Situation ethics rules rather than the precepts of God. It's clear when we take the admonition in Matthew 7 in context with the rest of the Bible that Christians are to make judgments, but they are to be righteous judgments based on the warnings we see in the Scriptures. As we analyze and judge what is right and wrong, we must base it on the mind of God as expressed in His Word. How we apply that judgment to others is important, for Christ will take the same attitude with us that we take with others. And we want that attitude to be gentle, don't we? We want it to be patient and humble. That's the attitude we all want. And I'm sure that's the way we should be treating others as well. So let's be careful. Let's not fall into the trap of tolerance that the world around us advocates. But instead, let's use the Scriptures properly in our lives to make righteous judgments.